we all could have done better over the last few hours or last few days in dealing with this situation. But this was a Rob Porter that I and many others have dealt with, that Sarah dealt with, that other officials, including the chief of staff, had dealt with. And the emerging reports were not reflective of the individual who we had come to know.
White House Deputy Press Secretary Raj Shah speaking with reporters today about how the administration responded to a scandal surrounding Staff Secretary Rob Porter. Porter announced yesterday he was going to resign after it was reported that his two ex-wives accused him of physical and emotional abuse. Porter denies the accusations. New reports suggest that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly may have known for months about the claims against Porter, and yet he still promoted him. Communications Director Hope Hicks, who is reportedly dating Porter, may have helped draft the administration's response. Well, to talk about all this, we have Andrew Prokop. He is senior politics reporter for Vox. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so here we have the White House on the defense. How big a deal is this scandal?
Well, it's getting to be a bigger deal. At first, it may have seemed like just an issue about, you know, this one staffer, Rob Porter, and his past. But now it's bringing to light larger issues about the security clearance process in the White House and also their judgment in considering how long they've apparently known about these allegations, which, as you've said, may have even been several months.
Right. So let's flesh out that security clearance issue, because the FBI had not given him a permanent security clearance. He had a temporary security clearance. And was it because of these abuse allegations?
It's not 100% confirmed, but that's what's generally believed to be the case, that, you know, when you join the White House, especially in a new administration, sometimes they have you start serving before your background check is done. So they might give you a temporary security clearance, and that's what Rob Porter got. But generally, after a few months or so, the background check gets completed, and then you get a permanent clearance or you don't. Porter, it's been over a year, and he still held this temporary clearance. And it has been confirmed that the FBI interviewed both of his ex-wives, who told them very similar things to what they're now saying publicly this week. Including, in one case, giving the FBI photo evidence of what his first ex-wife said was the effects of him punching her in the face. So it's definitely a questionable situation here about why he was allowed to hold on to this temporary clearance for so long, because, you know, one of the issues with this is that they do these background checks for a reason, because mm-hmm. if a staffer has scandals lurking in his or her past, it might be possible to blackmail that person.
Wow.
And government information, government secrets could be at risk.
Yeah, let me just play a clip of tape of one of the first ex-wife, Jenny Willoughby. No, the second ex-wife, sorry. She, this is what she apparently had told the FBI, and she told the Washington Post this on their website.
He was still angry, and so he came and grabbed me by the shoulders here and pulled me out of the shower in a rage. Immediately, on seeing the terror in my face, retracted and apologized and changed composure immediately. That was the first time that he had laid hands on me. That is the first time that anger had gone beyond the words and the insults and the regular rage that I had been accustomed to.
Okay, so that's Jenny Willoughby saying why, you know, she had alerted the FBI to his actions. So did Colby Holderness. And then there's a third woman, too, an ex-girlfriend, who apparently told someone else in the White House that she was afraid of him.
Yes, he divorced his second wife in 2013, and since then has dated several other people, and apparently one now ex-girlfriend of his, both reached out to the first two ex-wives in 2016, sending them texts basically making clear that she believed he hadn't changed his ways and that she was asking for their help at getting out of this relationship. And then also Politico reported that an ex-girlfriend of Porter's contacted the White House counsel, Don McGahn, in recent weeks and told him also of you know, allegations of abuse. And so that's raising questions about what Don McGahn knew. Why didn't why he didn't take action. And but as far as the White House as a whole, they were well aware of all this already.
So it was confirmed that they knew all of this because the FBI told them about it, but also that John Kelly in particular, even though he came on later, also knew about it months ago and did nothing about it.
Yeah, and Porter and Kelly have worked really closely together. The job that Porter held, White House Staff Secretary, it's a very important managerial job. It's key to kind of getting the bureaucratic trains running on time and so forth. And when Kelly came in and tried to bring some stability and order to what was a really chaotic White House, Porter was a crucial ally to him in that project. So it seems clear that Kelly really viewed him as indispensable and didn't want to let him go. So after these allegations started to come out this week, even when they had started to become public, Kelly released a statement calling him a man of great integrity and honor and basically defending him. It was only after further coverage, further revelations, and, you know, the scandal started to spiral out of control that Porter finally agreed to resign. And the Deputy White House Press Secretary, Raj Shah, today couldn't even sort of keep his story straight as to whether Porter was fired or whether he chose to resign.
Okay. Well, I guess it's going to keep this story will be unfolding. Where do you see it going from here? I guess it would be up to the president to fire Kelly or Hope Hicks.
Yeah. Reports suggest that Trump himself did not know about these allegations. It's not clear if Kelly told him. There are some people in Trump's orbit who have been view Kelly as a rival and want him out. And so I guess the question is right now whether this will kind of be the last straw for Kelly and whether Trump will think that it's time to make a change and kind of use this as the excuse to do it. I don't know how likely that is. It's certainly possible. He's fired a lot of people in the past. But as far as Hope Hicks, though, goes, it's a little tougher to imagine that she would be asked to leave because she's been at Trump's side since, you know, he launched his campaign in 2015 and is a really crucial part of his inner circle.
Andrew Prokop, senior politics reporter for Vox. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. While today's White House briefing was unfolding on cable news channels, the little stock market indicator bug in the corner of the screen was glowing red, screaming red, in fact. The stock market really hit the skids today. The Dow fell more than 1,000 points. That's more than 4%, down more than 10% from its high in January. So it's officially a correction. What is driving the sell-off? Should you sell your stocks? Should you buy bonds? Should you buy some gold bars? Put them under your mattress. David Lazarus writes about personal finance for the LA Times. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay. So what happened today? Is it just a normal bumpy ride on the stock market, or do you think this is an indication of something else?
Well, I'll tell you right out of the gate, what people should do is go out and buy some Dramamine, because this is the new normal. We got some volatility, and it's not going to go away. What you shouldn't do is freak out, because what we're seeing here is actually fairly healthy. It's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant, but it is fairly healthy because what started this pullback was a sense among investors that valuations had gotten ahead of where they should be, of where the fundamentals were for corporate earnings. And so you started seeing this pullback, which we haven't seen for many, many months now. And that's the market letting off some steam. And that's the market behaving the way it should behave. So that's a good thing. But then it kind of gathers steam in and of itself. And before you know it, there's more moving parts than just, hey, let's let off some steam. Now you have other elements that are in play. For example, concerns about inflation. And if indeed we see wages going up, is that going to cut into corporate bottom lines? And then also, if inflation is rising, does that compel the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates faster than they had been expecting? That, too, would cut into corporate bottom lines because it would make money more expensive to borrow, and less cheap money means less cheap money flowing around, which means, you know, you're going to have less investment in things. So now you've got a general sense of concern and worry, none of which reflect the basic solid fundamentals, and that is the economy is looking pretty strong. and corporate earnings are still looking pretty strong.
Yeah, so corporations just got this big tax cut. So why are they, you know, why is Wall Street, why are traders kind of not bullish on that?
Well, that's actually a very interesting thing, because now some analysts are wondering whether the Republican tax cuts haven't, in fact, overstimulated the market. Tax cuts, of course, are an economic stimulus. They free up new cash for companies to go out and do things like hire people or invest or buy other companies and, you know, whatever corporate things they get into their little heads. Well, we already have a very strong economy. Unemployment's at 4%. You've got good, you know, if modest growth going on for many, many months now. And there's a sense now that if you put too much stimulation into this economy, that's going to supercharge it, which again is going to raise the prospect of inflation, which again raises the prospect of higher interest rates. And so now there's some buzz out there that maybe the Republicans overstepped, overplayed their hand, and in fact goosed a market that didn't need any goosing. And that raises questions about, what do you do to rein that back? Do you raise taxes again? Well, that's not going to happen. So it's looking like what investors really want right now are some very clear signals from the Fed as to its intentions, because right now it's just a guessing game.
Mm-hmm. And it's tempting to look at the chaos in the White House, or the scandal du jour in the White House, as possibly having an effect that traders are looking at this as saying, well, it's not exactly steady going at the White House right now. There seems to be a lot of, there's a lot of drama. Does that play into traders' thoughts when they're deciding whether to sell?
You know, I think a lot of the drama coming out of the White House and out of Washington in general is baked into stocks at this point. After a year of the Trump administration, people kind of know that it's more Knots Landing than the West Wing. And they understand that, okay, this is a sense of chaos that we just need to grow inured to. Now, that doesn't mitigate having, you know, real general, you know, bona fide news moving the market. It will. It always will. But I think when we have these daily dramas and daily scandals that come out of Washington, the market sort of shrugs them off and then turns its attention back to things it really cares about, which in this case would be interest rates and corporate earnings, and, you know, and that's where it should be. And I do think the market was getting ahead of itself. I think the valuations were coming so far, so fast. You yourself noted that we hit a high for the Dow just 2 weeks ago, and now we're down 10% from there in official correction territory. When you see movements that large, that really suggests that the market wasn't on firm footing. And what we're seeing now is a process to find that footing again. And every Wall Street analyst out there is going to tell you that's not something that happens in a day. That's something that happens over multiple days or multiple weeks as investors try and figure out, where is that new foundation? Where is the new normal from which we can start playing again? And that's the process we find ourselves in now.
I guess I always hear, whenever we do these interviews or I listen to them, I always hear people like you say, just hang on, it's okay, don't sell, don't bail out, just hang tight, it'll be okay. But when do you sell? When should you get out?
You know, I'm kind of a buy and hold type, and that's the same thing that Warren Buffett is going to tell you. The thing that I think a lot of people really need to remember is, when you see massive selling, like a day like today, or wild swings like we've been seeing this week, by and large, that's not human beings at work. Those are computers at work. Those are algorithms that are trying to find sweet spots for buying and selling, and doing it in nanoseconds. And that's not a game we can play. So it's not like day traders getting onto Schwab.com and, you know, looking for ways that they're going to make some pennies here and there. This is Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and Quants and all sorts of scary sounding entities out there really, really moving fast and doing trades that mere mortals can't do. So in this Terminator-laden environment, I think the smartest thing for civilians to do, especially when they're keeping their eye on their 401k, first of all, take a deep breath, take that Dramamine I suggested before, and then step back and just realize you're not going to win this game. You're not going to win trying to time the market when you're going up against the HAL 9000 computer. Instead, you want to pick your spots. You know, if you've got a little extra money, wait for a pullback and then maybe put it in. But don't freak, because it's the people who freak out who then regret having made moves that were based not on good reason, but on emotion. And emotion is not your friend when it comes to investing.
David Lazarus. He writes about personal finance for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, trash talking in the city council. Even the LA lawmakers who approved a new recycling contract are mad about that contract. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. A hot mess, an embarrassment. Those words came from city council members this week who actually supported a citywide recycling effort. They are now turning against it because their constituents are really angry. Here's one of them who testified at a city council hearing this week.
What you have done is counterproductive, counterintuitive, and counter-free enterprise.
Bills are up, pickups are missed. No one is happy, it seems. David Zonheiser has been covering this for the LA Times. Hi, David.
Hello.
So, David, what's the problem?
Well, I mean, the problem is it's been a pretty bumpy rollout. Basically, last summer, they started putting the program into effect. And, you know, what this meant was changing the way trash is picked up for about 70,000 commercial customers. And what that means is businesses, office buildings, condominium complexes, larger apartments of like 5 units and up. You know, a huge number of people were given recycling bins, but also tens of thousands of them actually changed trash haulers. And so many of them saw their bills go up. And among those who did, a decent number had these extra fees added onto their bill, many of whom had not been charged extra fees before for certain kinds of service. For example, there's the notorious clicker fee, which is that the haulers can now charge to use a clicker to open a locked security gate to get into a garage and pull the bin out and have it emptied, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the contract is a $10 per visit charge to gain access to a secured building. Right. So but if you have that for the regular bin and the recycling bin over the course of a month, that can really add up. Right.
Yeah.
There's also what they call the distance charges. Right. And so under the contract that the city council and the mayor approved, the haulers can charge extra every time they have to pull the bin out of a garage and leave it on the curb if the distance is more than 100 feet. That's actually, I believe, $25 a visit. So that can also add up over the course of a month. You see where I'm heading with this?
I see. People,
and
a lot of extra people, yeah.
There's an extra $35 charge if the distance is more than 200 feet. So if you have like a really big complex and it's way in the back of the building, then they pull that. That's like a $35 hit every time a single bin is pulled to the curb to be emptied. Not every customer has gotten this. The estimates that I've gotten out of the city says that extra fees represent about a third of the customers that they've surveyed so far, and it's actually the number that's been hit by the distance fees is less than that. But for those who've had them, it's had this huge effect on their bills, where the bills have gone up double or in some cases triple. There are people who described a six-fold increase. That's an outlier, I would say. But you can imagine why people are so angry if your bill goes up by that magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why would city council members who actually proposed this, why are they now backing away from it? And why didn't they see the problems in the first place?
Well, that's sort of the big question. They're not, and here's the thing you need to understand, they aren't backing away from the program per se. It's a 10-year program. Nobody has suggested they end it. What they're saying is they hated the rollout, the 7 to 8 months rollout, and they're trying to figure out ways to fix it. And some of the things, I think, realistically, will work themselves out. And the city, the Sanitation Bureau, and the haulers themselves are saying they actually are being worked out. They're saying, you know, look, the drivers are learning their routes. They're figuring out what the access code is for these garages. So they're missing fewer pickups that sort of they thought the January numbers were promising in terms of reducing the number of missed collections. I can't imagine that by summer these companies won't know whose garbage they need to pick up, right? It just seems unfathomable to me. But the bigger question is, how are they going to resolve the issue of the bills, right? The city sent letters last fall saying that they thought some of these charges were invalid, one of which is the clicker fee, right? They say the clicker fee is not a valid fee. The haulers sent back letters saying it is. Well, how are they going to resolve that? Nobody's talking about ending the program, and frankly, I don't know how they would. These are 10-year contracts with seven significant players in the sanitation industry. But what they're trying to do is how to fix it and get their way out of a problem, which is they did approve these contracts, and now there are some outstanding issues.
I would say so. It's literally and figuratively a mess.
According to another councilman, yes. The funny thing is some of the meanest things said about the program were from the people who actually backed it most passionately.
Well, I guess they're just trying to come out of it politically okay, right?
Yeah, and I should point out, I mean, I mentioned that there were a number of angry customers. There were also people who were there who were advocating very strongly for the council to stay the course. You know, people who persuaded the council to do recycle in the first place, environmental groups, advocates for labor unions, community people, you know, they said it's still a good program and that, you know, punish the bad trash haulers if necessary, but keep it intact, you know. So there was a good contingent there of people, and they come to every meeting, you know, again, environmental activists, clean air people who are saying, do not back up on this program. And so I think what the city's trying to do is how they can get it into a place where it works better.
So is it doing the good stuff that it set out to do?
Well, I think so. I mean, the haulers have reported the purchase of, you know, scores and maybe hundreds of trucks to replace their fleet. I haven't seen numbers on the diversion, and that's something we're going to have to see in, I think, the coming months. It's possible. There was a 65-page report on the program, which I've read a good chunk of, but not every page. But definitely the advocates feel like this thing is doing what it's supposed to do. They acknowledge it's a bumpy transition, but there wasn't a better structure for doing these types of things.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to just see how it pans out. 10 years. That's a long time.
Well, we'll know sooner than that, because now the council wants all sorts of additional oversight of the program. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, you know, what precipitated all this is that the transition ended January 31st. So this was the first chance for everybody to kind of take stock of it and look at how it was going, right? So you're going to have way more of these types of meetings going forward. Now that, because basically their view is like the haulers don't have any excuse anymore. Like the transition is over, you know, there can be, you know, financial consequences from the city if they don't pick up the trash, and the city has to go pick up the trash for them, right? So mm-hmm. We're going to hear plenty more in the coming months.
David Zonheiser, LA Times reporter covering City Hall. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, LA artist Njideka Akinyele Crosby grew up in an Igbo tribe in a small town in Nigeria and came to the United States when she was 16. Her new mural on the Moca Building downtown is about the transition between rural and urban life across cultures.
The title of the mural is Obodo, Country, City, Town, Ancestral Village.
LA artist Njideka Akinyele Crosby next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're doing a series on the show called Blank Slate about Los Angeles artists, the artists who shape LA and who are shaped by LA.
this work could have never come out of the East Coast.
It's like a inside joke for a Japanese person living in Highland Park.
One scene kind of slips seamlessly into the other, and it jumps through time.
I'm not coming back home. LA is too interesting.
Skate and comics and underground comics.
We would pass Simon Rodia building the Watchtower.
In LA, like, anything can happen.
Today, Njideka Akinyele Crosby. Njideka is originally from Nigeria. Her paintings are layered with found photographs and materials from her two homes, images from a friend's wedding in North Dakota or an African Michael Jackson cover band. She didn't pick up a paintbrush until she was 16 years old. And now at 35, she is one of the biggest rising stars in the art world. Last year, she received the MacArthur Genius Grant. Her paintings sell for millions of dollars to private collectors in museums like LACMA, the Whitney, and the Tate Modern. Large-scale reproductions of some of her paintings are now covering the MoCA building in the form of a mural, and you'll see them if you drive along Grand Street. She lives here in L.A. Her studio's in the Arts District, and Njideka is in our studio now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's talk a little bit about your roots. You grew up in a small village in Nigeria, and then you moved to the big city, Lagos, the immense city, Lagos, to go to boarding school, an exclusive boarding school. Tell us about that transition. What was that like?
Sure. I grew up in Enugu, which is a town, but I did spend my weekends and summers in the village with my grandmother. It was a very quiet town, very homogenous. Everybody I knew growing up wasn't just Nigerian. They were all Igbo, which is my tribe. Mm-hmm. Everybody spoke the same language. Everybody I knew was Christian. All our family friends were from very similar socioeconomic backgrounds. And so moving to Lagos was quite tough for me because I was the parochial girl who was not cool at all. I didn't know the latest songs. I mean, songs from the UK and the US, the fashion, the movies, the stars. And I really was the fresh-faced girl who was lost in a big city. That was such a formative experience for me. I really enjoyed it, and it opened up this quest for me to explore the world outside my little town even more. And so when I was still in secondary school, my mother entered the family for the diversity visa lottery,
uh-huh,
which is
the
in the news a lot right now.
Thing that Donald Trump wants to get rid of.
Trying to stop. Yeah. So my mother got it, and because she got it, all the children got it, and that was why I moved to the United States.
Now, for people who don't know what this is something that is basically like the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
It is just given out by chance.
Yes.
There's a certain amount set aside for various countries, and it's just by chance that you get it.
Yes, I think it's something like 50,000 people get mm-hmm. it out of 20 million
yeah.
applicants.
Did you feel like you had won the golden ticket at the time?
Yes. It was very exciting for my family because that really was the only way we could have come to the United States. My mom understood that the opportunities were more for us if we did get the green card lottery and move to the United States. And that ended up proving particularly true for me, because when I was in Nigeria, I was a science person. I've always loved biology and the sciences. So had I stayed in Nigeria, I would have applied to university for medicine and I would have gone on to become a doctor. The United States system is very different. And I think my parents wanted that for us. They wanted us to have the chance to take liberal arts colleges and decide what we wanted to do. And that ended up being amazing for me because it was while I was at Swarthmore College that I decided to become an artist and decided to take more art classes and realized I really liked it and that was what I wanted to do. And after Swarthmore, I was at this crossroad and I took time off and I went back to Nigeria and I lived there for a year. And that really was when the decision happened. And what it was for me was having been in the United States for 5 years and going back to Nigeria that 1 year, it just reminded me of how much I loved the country, and it made me so aware of the fact that the country I knew and had grown up in and the country I came back to, which is actually different from the country I grew up in. That's the exciting thing about being from a developing economy. The country changes every year. And when I went back, there was just this palpable excitement in the country that I felt, because there was this cultural renaissance happening in literature with someone like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, in the movie industry with Nollywood, in fashion, in music. And I just felt like it was a very exciting period as a Nigerian. And I could, there was this sense of Nigerians stepping up and saying, we want to tell our own stories. We don't want to wait for people to do it for us anymore, because it just doesn't work.
And how did that go over with your family?
It took a while. I think every Nigerian out there will get this. So Nigerians esteem very practical careers, medicine, law, engineering, finance. So I think it was a hard sell to make that I wanted to do art. And I understand, because if you think of it, they had done all this stuff, taken the gamble on the lottery, worked extra hours, sacrificed for us to have a better life. And so it was great that I was in Nigeria for a year, because I could talk to them every day. So it was like a whole year of trying to convince them of my decision. And I think the good thing about having that kind of time is that it made it clear that this was not a random choice. It wasn't just something I was maybe considering. So the fact that you come today and I still say I want to do this, and next month I still want to do this, and the month after, my decision has not changed. So I think we finally got to a point where they did not agree with me, but they know that I'm very stubborn and that I was going to do it anyway. So they let me be.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Njideka Akunile Crosby. She's an artist who lives and works here in Los Angeles, and her work is up now on the Mocha Building on Grand Street. That's a big mural. You can see it if you walk along Grand Street, and you should get out of your car and walk along Grand Street and check it out. Let's talk about your marriage. And you married, I know. You married a white guy that you met in college. And I understand that your family was a little eyebrows raised about that. But you refer to, or you have him and yourself in your work a lot.
Yes. I'm laughing because when I talked about the 1 year in Nigeria, this was the other part of it.
Oh, I see. So they had to find out that you want to be an artist and that you're marrying
exactly
a white
American. It was a very high drama year.
So
there was an impromptu family meeting. He did not expect it. He was visiting as my friend. And there was the big gathering in the living room, which had this circular feel to it, with uncles, all my siblings, aunts, and Justin had to explain what his intentions. Yeah. Oh, no. He had to
did he actually have to speak to your father? And
he
say...
did. He hadn't even proposed at that point, but yes. So my little brother keeps saying, like, after that family meeting, that was when I knew Justin was a keeper. because he handled it very well. And I still don't think it's an issue, but I think the main concern, as I understand it as I get older, is that the culture moves through the father. So if I marry a non-Igbo person, my children are not Igbos. So it's almost like I have left my people. That line has diverged.
But do you think that?
I don't. This is all what I'm trying to grapple with in my work. So I feel like I'll always be Igbo. You'll never leave me. But there are little things that will hit you every once in a while. So, for instance, everybody has an ancestral village, which is part of the title for the Moka piece. And so when I talk about village, that's what I'm talking of. And you tend to go back to your ancestral village for big occasions, New Yam Festival, Christmas, Easter, what have you. And your ancestral village is usually your father's village.
Mm-hmm.
And when, as a girl, when you marry, ancestral village becomes your husband's village. So there is that part of me that thinks, if I was going, taking my child to the village, I'll go to my father's house in the village. But they actually don't see me as belonging there anymore because I'm married out. But I don't care. I'll make my own rules. So I think things are changing with my generation, and people realize you can make your life what you want of it. So,
well, let me ask you this. How do you feel about your success?
I'm really grateful for my success. I didn't expect it to happen so quickly and to this extent, just the intensity and the speed at which it happened. But what it makes me feel is gratitude, because the more I succeed, the more people see the work. I love that last year I had pieces on view in Turkey, in New Orleans, in Baltimore, in Venice. So you're really getting different demographics. I like to think that my work challenges this one-dimensional representation of Africa. The Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie describes it as the single story. Hmm. And she warns against the danger of the single story of Nigeria or Africa at large as a place of only poverty, famine, like nothing good can come
Boko
from
Haram
there.
Boko in Haram. Nigeria. Right.
And that's not all there is to it. This is a multi-dimensional space with different types of people living different lives. And I wanted to make stories about the lives that I saw and I lived growing up. So I really love that more and more people are getting to see the work. And that's why I'm so excited about the Moka mural, because it's on the Grand Avenue facade of the building. So that means you don't even have to be part of the museum-going demographic to see this work.
You can just walk up to it and look
exactly.
at it. Exactly. What is the title of the mural?
So the title of the mural is Obodo.
Obodo.
Country, city, town, ancestral village. So Obodo it's an Igbo word, and it's one word that has multiple meanings. So when we're in Enugu and we're going to our ancestral village, we'll say, Aina no Obodo, we're going to the village. But when you're in Nigeria and you're traveling, you say, Anameje Obodo Igbo, I'm going to the white person's place. And so it's still Obodo, but now meaning a country. But also you can say Obodo for Lagos or no Obodo Lagos. So I really like this idea of this one word that embodied all those things. And the reason why I settled on that is that all the pieces I used for the mural, a lot of the pieces I used for the mural had this kind of pull between cosmopolitan and rural.
Okay, let's talk about one of them. It's called Super Blue Omo. And I'm going to just play a clip of tape from a TV commercial that maybe you saw or maybe you didn't see.
There's only one original superior blue washing powder, and that's Super Blue Omo.
Oh, this is amazing. Oh,
so
wow.
So your painting is named after, this is a laundry detergent, right?
Oh,
surprise.
Did the audience hear this?
Yeah.
Oh God, every Nigerian now, anybody who grew up in Nigeria in the 80s and 90s just had a flashback.
Okay, so for those of us who didn't, what are we flashing back to?
So a little bit of a background. I mentioned we didn't have satellite television, so we all watched NTA, Nigerian Television Authority. It started about 6 in the evening and ended at 10. So everybody watched the same thing. And there were just a handful of commercials, so they played on repeat. You could sing them backwards and forwards.
So these are like your lullabies.
Yes.
These are like in your consciousness.
The soundtracks of my childhood. So Super Blue Omo, you probably heard it once every 30 minutes from 6 in the evening to 10 at night. Every day from when you were like 6 to when you were 12. And so I finally thought of that. And I wanted to get a picture that if you saw it, it not only took you back to that time, you heard the song in your head.
And just so like we heard it.
You just go, Omo, Omo, Super Blue, Omo. So, anyway.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Madeline. This was great.
Gosh, it's been such a pleasure. That's Njedeka Akunile Crosby. She's an artist who lives here in LA. Her work, Obodo, is up now on the Mocha Building on Grand Street. It's a mural. It'll be there for all of 2018, all year long.
Yes, I'm very excited about it.
Okay, so you have lots of time to check it out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, why ski jumpers jump today, the day before the Winter Olympics officially begin. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Opening ceremonies for the Winter Olympics begin tomorrow, but a couple of sports have already begun their competitions. Curling, we talked about that earlier this week.
Hard! Hard!
Hard guy!
Hard!
And ski jumping.
A lot of speed in that track. Now look out!
And look at him go!
Oh! Oh, baby. What a terrible fall.
Oh, no. Well, hopefully there won't be any of that this year. The men's ski jumpers started their competition early this morning. Everyone landed safely, but it's not just the men who get to jump anymore. 4 years ago in Sochi, women ski jumpers competed at the Olympics for the very first time. This year, the U.S. is sending 4 men and 3 women to the Games, and here to tell us more and to tell us more about the sport of ski jumping is our resident Norwegian. Press Play producer Christian Bordahl, hi.
Hey there.
How did the men do today?
The men did really well. The good news, all 4 qualified, so they're all going to be getting to jump in the normal hill. 3 of them were kind of short. They only jumped about 88, 90 meters, whereas the winners jumped about 104. But Kevin Bickner has been jumping really well for the men, so he's the guy that he's been jumping like in the top 10 in the practice jumps and for the last couple of days. So he's the guy that probably will do the best for the men.
Okay, how about the women?
So the women don't have a qualification round. If they get into the Olympics, they get to automatically go to the event. But they only have one event. They only get to jump on this normal hill, which is the smaller hill, whereas the men get to jump on the larger hill, and they also have a team event. So the men have 3 events, and the women only get 1 event.
Why do they only get 1 event?
So it's old attitudes. I'm afraid, you know, it took a long time, as you were mentioning, for the women to get in to do ski jumping at all in the Winter Olympics. And part of that is just old attitudes. The former FIS, the International Ski Federation president, is famous for saying, quote, "seems to not be appropriate for ladies from a medical point of view for them ski jumping." So I actually talked recently with Abby Ringquist, who's one of the ski jumpers who's going to be going to the Olympics for the U.S., one of the 3. And I asked her about this whole thing, about this idea that, you know, is it dangerous for women? And here's what she had to say.
No, not at all. I mean, if you look at some stats, ski jumping is the 3rd safest Winter Olympic sport behind curling and cross-country skiing. And, you know, everybody can get hurt, but we, it's ski jumping. We, you know, signed up for this, understanding that there was a possible risk potential. And yeah, injury is inevitable with athletes and with all sports. And, you know, I don't think that that was the main reason they left us out of the Olympics for so long.
What does she think is the main reason?
Well, I mean, first of all, there is a risk element, right? You're going like 50, 60 miles an hour off a jump and flying, you know, 120, 130 yards, even on just the normal hill. But she thinks that it's a male-dominated sport. The boys have been doing it a long time, and it's run by men. And she thinks that the men are just concerned about the women looking just as good as they are. Because the fact is that the women can jump just as far as the men. It's all about how much speed you get off the jump. And that is monitored by how far up or down they put the boom on the jump. So, you know, they move you further up the hill to get started, then you get more speed off the hill. And there are cases where women have taken the, you know, the biggest jump in a particular hill, you know, had the hill record, where, and, you know, she thinks that maybe the men don't like that so much.
And also, wouldn't it be better to be smaller because you go further?
It is better to be smaller, but it's also important to have a lot of power going off the jump itself. And so that's where the men, I think, have a little bit of an edge over the women. But, you know, it's also interesting thing about ski jumping is that it's not just the jump itself that is dangerous for athletes, but there are it's also a sport that has a lot of problems with eating disorders.
Because of the smaller
Because of the aspect of, you know, exactly wanting to be lighter. There's an ugly old saying in ski jumping that fat don't fly.
There's a saying, fat don't fly, and that's pretty true when it comes to ski jumping. I myself have dealt with an eating disorder, and it's not fun. It's awful, but, you know, I'm better now, and I have a great relationship with food thanks to help from nutritionists. So, I mean, it's not easy, and especially when you show up to World Cups and you see athletes that look awful. You just want to go, oh, sweetie, eat a sandwich or something. But, you know, it's you can't really do that anymore because the sport is growing and that is how you go further.
Yeah. I mean, it really is true that when you're lighter, you fly further. Mm. And they say every additional pound of weight means that you're going to, you know, go a little bit shorter on the hill. And when you look at these ski jumpers, when they have taken off those big onesies that they wear when they go down the hill, they really look all of them very skinny. Yeah. Kevin Bickner, who I was just talking about, he's 6 feet. He's 138 pounds. Sarah Hendrickson, who's the best female jumper, she's 5'4". She's maybe 100 pounds. She's definitely had eating disorder issues. So it's something that's ongoing in ski jumping.
Okay, so it's not a big sport in the United States, ski jumping. Do our athletes do okay?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really, a lot of it is about financing, obviously. It's really hard to get sponsorships for a sport that isn't shown on TV. And so a lot of these ski jumpers, the U.S. ski jumpers, have had to pay their own way. Sarah Hendrickson or Abby Ringquist that I talked to, for example, said that $20,000 to $30,000 a year is what she spends just getting herself around the international competitions. She's worked three jobs while she trains just to be able to do that. So that, you know, obviously that's the kind of thing that makes it difficult for people to want to continue to compete. She's 28. She's been doing it for a long time. And now she's finally getting to go to the Olympics. So at least she's very excited about that.
Okay. Well, we'll look out for her and the other jumpers. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
The opening ceremony is tomorrow. That is so exciting. I can't wait. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.